Our first British Indian Prime Minister, a practicing Hindu, has stirred an intriguing debate. What matters is less his ethnicity and religion, but being a former head boy of top public school Winchester, going into Oxford, where he won a first, then Stanford University, before a career at Goldman Sachs. And whatever your politics, the fact that he's emerged as plainly clever, hard-working and high caliber is obvious to all. Class has trumped ethnicity. Or has it? It's a question my guest today, Professor Anne Phoenix from UCL's Institute of Education, has consecrated much of her research and working life. It's not class or race or gender that determines so many biographies' attitude to life. It's the intersection between them that matters. Whether you're a single mother under 20 or a British Prime Minister, and it's something I want to discuss with her today. These questions are also umbilically linked to another quality in short supply today's Britain, hope. Don't think of hope just in personal terms, she says. Acknowledge its social roots. The best hope is co-produced with others. Co-hope, she calls it. Anne Phoenix is one of our leading social psychologists, blending sociology with psychology to open up new ways of thinking. Delighted you can spare the time to join us on the We Society this morning, Anne. And my first question is the same as to all our guests. When we got in touch and said, would you come on the We Society, what was your first thought when you heard the phrase We Society?
I thought that was marvellous because, for a start, some people still think that really society is just a collection of individuals. And it's so important to use the word we. I think that coming from COVID, we've not finished with COVID yet, but really what we've learned from that pandemic is that we have to think more about collectivities. We have to think about ourselves as we. And if we don't, then we cannot deal with things like pandemic. We have to think we're all in it together for politicians to really think about policies that affect us all and to behave in ways consistent with that. And then to encourage us to feel that since we are responsible for other people as well as ourselves, we should act in ways that help to keep the pandemic down as much as possible. So the We Society is just a fantastic term.
Well, I'm delighted that you're such a warm endorser of the concept of the We Society, which I helped coin. But let's just go on. You've made that resounding opening statement. And then there's this question of kind of intersectionality, which I know dominates your thinking, this intersection between class, gender and race. And, you know, and I've raised the question of Rishi Sunak as kind of embodying that. I mean, it's plainly class that's driven him to where he's got to in British society, and ethnicity is secondary. Or is it? I mean, give us your take.
I'm so pleased that you've raised the question of intersectionality, because one of the issues that I think people have got slightly wrong when thinking about a cabinet that's more diverse than any other so far in British society.
And you speak as a woman of colour, and this should be said.
Yes, most definitely, is thinking that therefore it means that no longer does racialization, does ethnicization matter at all, and that we can concentrate only on individual talent. Or, as you've just said, they think that, okay, class has trumped race. So really, we know that class is crucially important in British society as it is. So, you know, we always knew it's not a racist society, it's about class. And in a way, that very thinking again individualizes.
Yep.
Because what it doesn't do is what intersectionality theory is designed to do, which is think about the way in which the social categories to which we belong all mutually construct each other when they intersect. So it's always the case that people are in several categories at one and the same time. And of course, class is crucially important. But Rishi Sunak has not got away from the fact that he is a British Asian, and that will have an impact on how he's received, how he's positioned, what people expect from him, and it will do so within social class and gendered terms, as well as the other categories to which he belongs to do with religion, etc. and so on. We cannot say that one is more important than the other. Now, there are contexts where one social category clearly seems to be making more of a difference than others. So in some contexts, the fact that he's British Asian won't be something that's making a difference. So when he's with lots of other Asian people who themselves are affluent, then of course being Asian won't make a difference at all. But the very fact that people need to stress all the time how this shows what Britain is like, rather than when somebody who's white and male comes to power saying this shows that society again has privileged somebody who's white and male, the fact that it's a focus on the Asianness is important in itself. And the fact that masculinities, maleness, is not mentioned when people are talking about him in that way, shows that actually the social categories do make a difference, but that we have to think about them as socio-structural. Which things do people see as making a difference? Which things do they see as extraordinary about people? And I think that that has to be borne in mind. Now, I just want to add that some people have also, in trying to understand the cabinet, and rather the previous cabinet, because we've had a few lately, said things like, well, this shows that she's not properly black, to refer to some members. And I think that that also, from a different direction, misses what intersectionality is about. Because if class, gender, social class, gender, and also ethnicity are all mutually constituting each other, you cannot say that somebody is not being properly black because there's no essence to blackness. It's not that you can say that this is what it means to be black and list characteristics, because always blackness is decentered, is changed by the other social categories to which people belong. So that's equally simplistic from a different direction.
Very intriguing. I mean, there's so many things to pick up and run within that. The first thing that crossed my mind as you were speaking is that, are you saying that as important in all the commentary about Rishi Sunak is that no one observes that had he been a British Asian woman, the story could have been very different?
That may well have been the case. And of course, I'm not taking away from Rishi Sunak's talents, but just let's step back a little bit, because this is the second time that Rishi Sunak, in a short life and a short time frame in the British context, has stood for election as the Prime Minister. He was popular with MPs previously, as he was this time, Conservative MPs, but he was not popular, not so popular anyway, comparatively with Liz Truss, with Conservative voters in the country, Conservative members. So one has to ask the question, is this so clear that therefore Asianness does not matter? Or do we have to take a slightly more complex view and ask questions about, you know, when does it matter? With whom? When there's a choice, would he always be downplayed? Is it the case, as we know happens often for women, for example, that you're more likely to be elected when, for example, there's problem in an organisation, there's something that needs to be mended? It's much more likely that women will get jobs, top jobs. It's much more likely that other people will be brought in who wouldn't otherwise be considered. We have to ask the questions. We can't be absolutely sure. But let's take a more complex view and analyse what's going on, rather than knee-jerk views about Asians, about class and so on.
Now, we've been talking for a few minutes, and another element of your thinking has struck me, is that you tend to pose these points as questions. But it's pretty clear where you're coming from when you pose the question. You know, implicit in the question is the answer. I mean, basically you're saying, you know, we should ask the question whether what matters about Rishi Sunak is only his class, because plainly his ethnicity and race does matter. But you're not quite saying that as a fact. Can I push you a bit? Is it a fact?
Well, the point about intersectionality is that all the categories to which we belong matter. But of course, some categories don't matter in particular contexts.
Let's dispense with Rishi Sunak with this last question and then move on to other things. I mean, in what way would you say his maleness mattered? I mean, what way would you say the fact he's a Hindu matters? Over and above, you know, his evident membership of the British establishment.
Yes. Well, maleness, there are certain things that can be taken for granted still in 21st century Britain. That actually, if you're male, that masculinity carries with it a certain authority, a certain expectation that you will be more likely to rise to the top than a woman peer. So that still matters, but also along with it, socio-structurally, it's also a heterosexist society still, even though it's changed enormously, so that there are expectations that you will be supported by somebody at home and that you will have children that actually help you to be a model for the British society or indeed for many other societies. So masculinity does matter. And the stance that people can take, what's expected, does matter. A woman, an Asian woman, first has to break through that notion that actually they're different. What is it that they have to offer that can make them as good as the expected male, as well as the expected white person? So by disrupting expectations, they are much more likely to be subject to scrutiny. So by being male, Rishi Sunak avoids that part.
Which an Asian woman would have had more, you think, than, let us say, an Anglo-Saxon white woman like Liz Truss. That's what you're saying, yeah?
I'm saying that you've posed it in a rather simple quantitative way, you know, more than.
Yeah, fair enough.
But it's not quite like that, because, of course, a white woman, and there have been three white women prime ministers in Britain, two fairly recently, and we know that women are, their clothes, their manners, their partners, whether or not they have children, they're all subject to scrutiny. So it's not that white women have an easy time, because they're also breaching expectations. They're also having to do more often to prove themselves in context. And if, like Margaret Thatcher, they prove to be strong, people then begin saying that they're like men, you know, sort of, rather than being typically women, typically in quotes. So I'm not saying that a white woman would have it easier necessarily, but there are there's both the Asianness and the woman that's disrupting the expectations about what a prime minister looks like if it were an Asian woman.
Now, we've been discussing someone evidently very successful, but I mean, your work is kind of not only focused on what happens at the top of British society, it's also focused on, you know, what happens kind of further down the ladder. I mean, one interesting piece of work is your work on single mothers under 20. And again, I mean, applying your kind of this kind of perspective of intersectionality to that. And again, what's the conclusion we should draw from your work?
Well, talking about that piece of work, which also did include the few married mothers under 20 that there are, because some are married, since you can at 16 marry. But I mean, I want to, since we've been talking about politicians, I want to give two examples then of politicians, women who've had children before they were 20. And I don't know if you remember Victoria Bottomley, who married another MP called Peter Bottomley.
Yes, I know Victoria Bottomley.
And she had a child before, you know, what? In fact, I think very early on while she was a student at Essex. well, she and Peter both were. And because of their class position, they were able to still go on. They both managed to become politicians. They were successful. She finished her degree and so on. And indeed, we only learned about that, the fact that she had become a mother under 20 rather later on. Think about Angela Rayner, deputy leader of the opposition at the moment. And she was also a mother before 20, but for her in very different circumstances, impoverished. So that her route to Parliament and to a stellar career so far has been much more tortuous, much more difficult, and something that is raised both by the media and that indeed she's open about as part of her background, which for Virginia Bottomley was not at issue. We didn't learn that until she chose to reveal it much later in debates. So just those different intersecting things to do with class, as well as gender, as well as having a child under 20, makes a difference. And most, in fact, most people who have children under 20 are impoverished. But it used to be the case that since it was common to marry early, that the middle classes also had children under 20, but very, very different outcomes. And indeed, if you were affluent enough, you did not have to worry about raising your own child. The nanny would do a great deal and you could get on with doing other things. Not so somebody like Angela Rayner and the people in my study. The mothers in my study, they fell into very many different groups, but quite often having a child under 20 for them, coming from working class roots, often living in poverty, that having a child was often something that impelled them to think, well, now I must do something else. I must work in some way so that I can make things better for my child, so that it actually gave them a hope for the future that meant that their actions differed. They also said things like, well, you know, I didn't mind if I got pregnant or not, because there was nothing that would be disrupted by having a child. And if you compare that with somebody who's about to go, for example, to Oxbridge and so on, there's a great deal that would be disrupted, particularly because in this country, and we always have to think about the state, the nation in which we live, in this country, there aren't the arrangements that would give such a woman time off to look after her child and still ensure that she could manage financially, as indeed in the Nordic countries would be more likely to be the case.
But your study did show, I mean, I'm not sure what the levels of child support were when you did it, but your study did show that actually these mothers were quite successful at rearing a child single-handedly. I mean, against the kind of view that actually single parenthood is, you know, always second best and sometimes a disaster.
Yes, and immediately I would say that none of those who were rearing their children successfully did so single-handedly. I mean, it's rather like remembering the adage that it takes an African one. It takes a village to raise a child.
The subject of Hillary Clinton's book, yeah, who I interviewed in the last series of We Society.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, you know, they had support from their own parents who were young enough to give that support, and support in all sorts of ways, with childcare, financially, even though it was very, very limited financial help that they could give, in terms of time and company and so on. So that they had that support that buttressed what the state gave them socioeconomically, but also made sure that their children were born into and lived in contexts where they were valued and where there was a social structure for them to be in.
Just a quick break in the conversation to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time, from the cost of living crisis to the war in Ukraine. In every public or private sector strategy room in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff or Belfast, you'll find a social scientist. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at acadsocsciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. I mean, where does this all kind of land? Because, I mean, we discussed intersectionality, we're now discussing single parenthood, and what's the kind of intellectual landscape that sits behind all this, and where does it lead you in terms of, if we made you kind of leader of the country for a day, what you would do?
If you made me leader of the country for a day, it wouldn't be enough. By the time people had finished interviewing me, it would be over. But anyway, that's just a joke. They would be so astonished. If I were to be in charge of policies, it would have to be that I think we need to change mindset for what we do. I think that individualising social issues like child rearing, like reproductive policies and so on, like the funding that we give to people in general, not just parents, but to people for their everyday living, would have to shift. The substrate, the background to it would have to shift, in that we would need to be able to think about what people need in order to have a good life, and a good life that's not so different from the lives that, for example, the middle classes now want to live. In other words, the huge differentials would have to be ironed out, because we recognise that people have intrinsic value, and that if we want the best for society, we know from so much research that we need much more egalitarian societies, that we need the differentials not to be so great, and also that we need to think about the fact that we are forever individualising childcare, privatising it into families, expecting people to do the best for their children, and then we depend on those children. So that, for example, Rishi Sunak at 42 will be highly dependent on the children born now to be working when he is in his 70s and 80s and providing for the country. Well, why can't we help to bring those children up a little happier?
Is it income, or is it capacities, or is it both? I mean, there's a big debate kind of amongst egalitarian theorists about really where the focus should be. I mean, you have an Amartya Sen will say it's about capacities, it's about giving people the equipment to live a life they have reason to value, and that's not just about ensuring that there's kind of income support. It's about everything to do with living a life well, emotional intelligence, capacity to listen, capacity to form relationships, all of that. Where are you on that debate?
Well, I certainly think that income is crucially important, and that we need to ensure that people have enough to live on in the society in which they are. I also agree that it's not enough. But one of the things that I think I disagree with the capabilities approach about, so Amartya Sen, Martha Nussbaum and so on, is that frequently the capabilities are individualised again. And the point is that being able to listen, being able to really think through options and so on, having the capacity to do things, is not an individual achievement. Let's just take a step away and think about resilience. Because resilience is often picked out as something that we want to foster in children. Of course, we want children to be as able as possible to live within the society. But resilience, as many people now recognise in theorising it, is not an individual achievement. So there's a really good study by Hauser and Woods and other colleagues in the United States, which was longitudinal, following up children and young people who'd had really some of the worst starts in life. And those who, when they were in their 30s, proved to be resilient were very much...
You just put inverted commas around resilient.
Yes,
I should
exactly.
tell the listeners. Yes, yeah.
And I do that because it's not individual. I mean, obviously, those children made use of opportunities, but those opportunities had to come, and sometimes those were serendipitous. They were meeting someone who believed in them and therefore actually coming to see that that person was affording them opportunities that they could use and also ways of understanding that they could transfer to other situations. It was relational. So who was in their social sphere? It was not something that was inborn or that they had to be taught individually.
I've often thought that of my own life, you know, that in particular points has been someone I've encountered through the relationship network I've had who's been actually fundamentally important to getting me to the next stage. That's my life. What about your life?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because then I would like to point to somebody called Major Brian Hordle. And it's most unlikely. I left school at 18 because I was really rather lazy at the time and didn't think I wanted to go to university because I didn't want to work, which, you know, I find even surprising looking back, since I've worked fairly hard since. The
Major?
First, Major Brian Hordle. He's dead now. I mean,
Major Brian Hordle.
Yeah.
A military man, I'm guessing, or not?
Well, he worked at International Maritime and Telecommunications Region, which is now International Telecommunications.
I mean, is this in Britain?
It's in London.
Yeah.
It was named differently then. And I went in at a junior clerical post, but at the bottom of the Society of Post Office Executives, because it was then part of the post office at 18. And Major Brian Hordle, who he spent his spare time doing military things, as well as being in charge of the section that I was in for his day job. So he believed in me. Now, he was a white man whose opinions would be so different from mine. He was very sexist and misogynist. And he really, as a black young woman, wished that I was his daughter. He had two daughters, and he didn't seem to rate them highly. He called his wife an old biddy. But what he did was say, this place isn't good enough for you, you must go to university. And what I will do is organise so that you can have this as a holiday job. So I'll organise special leave C for you, and you can come back every holiday, do the job, and we'll keep your job open so you've got somewhere to come back to, and I hope you'll come back to it. So I went to university on that basis when I hadn't intended to, but was very bored at this job.
Really. Yeah, low-level clerical jobs. I had a few in my own career. They're not, yeah. I mean, you spend most of your time thinking, I've got to stop doing this. That's actually quite important. I mean, it helps give you real ambition. I've got to get out of this. Yeah. So off to university.
Yes, but...
Off to university. Yeah. What did you study at university? In which university?
At St Andrews. And really, I applied for different things at different universities. So if I'd gone to one, I would have done economics. If I'd gone... And so on. Anyway, I went to St Andrews. And one of the things that was lovely about that is it's much more like a liberal arts because it's a Scottish system. I did, three subjects in the first year. And I did philosophy, economics, and for the third option, I thought, still being relatively lazy, I would do psychology, since it would be, people had told me it would be an easy subject, an easy third. I loved it and flourished in it, and so ended up doing that as my degree.
And that's been your career,
years.
Really. That's been the origin
yes.
of your career. And that's how you've...
And I met such wonderful, peers, as well as young lecturers and so on, who were just wonderful. Again, proving that this thing is not an individual achievement, but it's where you are at the time, who you meet, and some of it is serendipity, but some of it is the most unlikely.
And it's extraordinary. I know. I had a teacher who convinced me at the age of 17 I was going to be a good economist. I don't know whether that's true, but anyway, he did. And then 10 years later, a man who said, a professor at INSEAD Business School, who said I should be a journalist. And those two men, you know, that's my life in a sense. I mean, you know, if I hadn't met them, it wouldn't have happened. And you're saying the same. So much, but yep, we're individualizing it or not.
No, we're not, because part of the point of that is that it's not an individual attribute. It's the whole constellation of things that people bring together, and that people are themselves not essentialized to one characteristic. You know, if you'd met Brian Hordle, you would not have thought that he would be the sort of person that would encourage a young black girl to, you know, young woman, as I was then at 18, to do anything in British society. But he was. So it's psychosocial. It's always structural within a context, but it's also always psychic and the individual relationality as well.
Psychosocial?
Yes.
Go on, let's have three sentences on that.
Okay.
So our listeners can really get it.
Well, psychosocial is really about the fact that one cannot understand the world, the social world, without always having in mind the psychological and the social, and not seeing them as separate, but really always inextricably linked. So, you know, many, many people have, within psychology, have thought about, is it the individual or society? And indeed, some of our conversation already has been a bit like that. Is it the individual? Is it society? What does that mean?
You're always pulling, in Fenister, you always pull it back to the connections.
Exactly. And in sociology, the structure agency dichotomy that many people feel is not good enough. It doesn't help us enough. So therefore, the psychosocial, it's a heuristic, partly always reminding us that we have to bring these things back together. And people do it in different ways. But it's...
So intersectionality leads to the psychosocial.
For you,
I mean, leads to something else, which I was kind of picked up in your thinking, which is this notion of hope. It's when I first encountered you, when you were talking about hope. And you made the point, I mean, and I think, by the way, I think it's kind of very, I mean, I, you know, we need to hope more. And it's a moment not to hope. I mean, there's so many things that kind of people are deferring having kids, not having kids because they just think, you know, the world is going down. You know, climate change, tensions, you know, you don't want to bring a child into this world. You know, lots of that around. And people can, you know, consumer confidence, business confidence. I mean, what's happening to Putin and Ukraine? So many reasons not to hope. But you say hoping is not an individual act. You say hoping is something we do together. You say, and you've coined this phrase, co-hoping. And I'm very intrigued by that. And actually, if we could co-hope more, we might hope more. Over to you.
Well, I didn't coin co-hoping in that I read it from Hassan Haj, who in a 2016 paper argued that hope is differentiated in that people have inequities of hope, that how you're positioned affects how much you can hope, and that really if society's to change, we have to hope collaboratively. So co-hoping is the key thing.
Inequities of hope.
Yes.
That's of course you're right, but I've never thought of that. Here I am. After my 70th birthday, I've never heard of the notion. Of course, it's obvious. As soon as you say it, it's obvious.
Yeah. So that's Hassan Haj, who's an Australian anthropologist. And one of the other things, I mean, Les Back, who's a sociologist in Britain, talks about hope as being crucially important for future action. And that future action is, I'm arguing, differentiated by how you're positioned. So we need to really ensure that hope is something that's not at other people's expense, but that hope is collaborative. If we want a fairer future, we need to do that. And hope is crucial for future action. Many people say that. I mean, for example, Barack Obama, speaking to the UN General Assembly in 2014, talked about hope being absolutely crucial and for collective future action. So rather than fearing the future, we need to act in the future. And we can only do that through hope.
I'm going to wrap this up asking one last question. So wait for it. Having heard you, and again, I'm not going to ask you to be leader for a day any longer, because I'm just going to say, you know, as we leave the studio, and urging us to act collectively, where is your own focus for collective action?
Well, I think that collective action, for me, a lot of my collective action is to do with academic work, which may seem strange. But I really think that unless we can put things into words and theories that people can understand, then they don't have the possibility to make changes. I mean, you said you'd never come across Hassan Haji's notion of co-hoping, or indeed thinking about hope as unequally distributed. And that just goes to show that academic work is not abstruse. I mean, of course it can be, and abstract, but very much related to what one can do. So I believe that that is one way in which I make a collective contribution with thinking, but also with what one does for the next generation, for capacity building in the society, and arguing for change, so that I'm not the politician for a day, I'm not on the streets every single moment campaigning, but I hope that I make a contribution in that way.
And it's the role of social science to sign off. Thank you so much, Professor Anne Phoenix. You've really unpacked, I think, in the half an hour we've been talking, a kind of really important way, and a social scientific way of actually kind of looking at the way we as individuals, notwithstanding everything, are rooted in the society and structures around us, that you can't separate the psychology of hope from actually where you are in society, your capacity to hope. We certainly can't individualize race or gender or class. I mean, they're intersectional. And it's a way of looking at the world, which I think is a kind of call to social scientific arms. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Will. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to. If you enjoy the type of issues and guests addressed by the We Society, may we recommend Social Science Bites, a podcast series appearing on Sage Publishing's Social Science Space website. The monthly episodes offer 20-minute interviews with leading social and behavioural scientists, sharing their perspectives on how our social world is created, and how social science can help us understand people and how they behave. Social Science Bites back catalogue includes topics ranging from crowd psychology and behavioural economics to inequality and the fear of death, with guests such as Alondra Nelson, Steven Pinker, Nobel laureate Angus Deaton, and Al Roth, pioneering geographer Doreen Massey, Jennifer Richardson, Sheila Jasanov, John List, and Ruth Wodak. You can listen to Social Science Bites by visiting Social Science Space or wherever you get your podcasts.